This is a tape of Mrs. Henry F. Angus, done on August 17, 1979. Interviewer, Penny Washington. Mrs. Angus, I'd just like to begin by saying that we do have another tape of you, done by Gillian Campbell on UBC Faculty Women in January of 77, and that has most of your personal background and your family history, so we won't have to worry about that here. We would just like perhaps to talk about a few of the points that you made there. One was that in the first year, in 1919, when you came, you said it was quite difficult to adjust to things like the library, the lecture system, and so on from high school, and you were relatively new in town. So could you tell us how you managed it so successfully? Who helped you, or did you have acquaintances to contact, or organizations that contacted you on campus?
No, I had to work it out for myself, and I remember being considerably nonplussed when I had to start taking notes from a lecturer who spoke very rapidly, like Dr. Mm-hmm. Eastman. We talked very fast and a great deal.
He was in history, right?
In history. Mm-hmm. And in the first year, I had as a freshman, I had to take quite a large number of courses, mm-hmm. and there were three lectures a week, but there was an extra hour for any undergraduates who wished to take a fourth lecture in the course every week, and it was called a distinction course, mm. and extras were done. So the sky being the limit in my ambition to learn as much as I possibly could as fast as possible, I signed up for a distinction lecture in every one of my courses. And I found that it really kept me hopping to get the lecture notes done, and with the result that I was disappointed that I didn't do better in the final exams mm-hmm. at that stage because of the difficulty of adjusting to it. I remember it was quite a struggle. I'm sure I wore a very worried expression for that year. But after that year was over and my exams were written and I got the hang of it and mm-hmm. Made friends among the classmates and had very nice and considerate professors to mm-hmm. consult, all went well.
Good. Good. Did you have to clear that? Signing up for all your distinction courses with anybody in particular, or did you just assign?
Oh, no. No, I just did it on
Nobody
my
said
own.
That might be too much, Miss Anderson, or?
No, nobody did at all.
Oh, okay. By the way, did they have a freshet tea when you were there?
Yes, oh yes. And if I remember rightly, it was the faculty women who gave it. Mm-hmm. And as I think I mentioned to Gillian Campbell, the Faculty Women's Club felt very, as a whole, very motherly mm-hmm. toward all the women mm-hmm. undergraduates and were extremely kind to us. Mm-hmm. I mean, we could always, for instance, the wife of one or other of our professors would always be ready to give a helping hand if we had any problems. Because, of course, there was no woman on the staff but Isabel McGinnis mm-hmm. then, and she was a very fine and dependable person, but rather frightening to mm-hmm. the young new people because she, like many very small women, mm-hmm. Was very much on her dignity mm-hmm. and in her general manner rather abrupt. But she had an awfully kind heart and I grew to be very fond of mm-hmm. Isabel.
Mm-hmm. The next year, 1920-21, you certainly had fitted in very well because you became Vice WUS President. Was it the next year?
Yes, in my... No, I was Secretary WUS my second year.
Second year.
In the third year, I looked up in the yearbooks here. Mm-hmm. In the third year, I was on the Literary and Scientific mm-hmm. Executive. Mm-hmm. And not on the women's undergrad executive. And the fourth year I was elected president.
I see. How did nominations go about? Were there many girls that were interested in taking executive positions, or were there just a few?
which
Well, I don't remember in detail about that. I think that as any in any group of women, there are a handful
mm-hmm.
who immediately occur to the general body of the organization as people who would be all right in executive
mm-hmm.
positions of some sort. Of course, they were divided up. There was the athletic, the women's athletics was very, very active then. They had a very fine grass hockey team,
mm-hmm.
for example. And they had their own representative.
Mm-hmm.
And then the literary historical people had theirs, and so on. So there were different general areas of interest with them.
Right. Then I asked you about caution money,
mm-hmm.
which was
to cover any breakages or losses, say, of library books or breakages in chemistry would be considerably more. They wouldn't be covered by that. You might have to have extra. I don't remember. I didn't take it at QVC, so I don't know.
And you'd pay that in at the beginning of the year,
yeah,
and get it back.
That's right.
When you were there, were they the campaign beginning up for the Women's Union Building? To have that started?
You mean downtown? Or the
no, on campus, to eventually have a place where women could have social events.
Oh dear me, you see, no, because we were on the General Hospital grounds
mm-hmm.
there, and I don't remember any movement of that kind
mm-hmm.
until after we got out to UBC,
mm-hmm.
you see, and then the Mildred Brock
mm-hmm.
and so on. No, not Women's Union that early.
I found out that you were on the debating team in 1921 with Dorothy Walsh.
Oh, yes.
And you won with the affirmative, "For women have had more influence on civilization than men." Do you remember that? Any of the arguments for that?
I had forgotten entirely until I looked at the annual that I'd been on that team.
Oh, yes.
It must have been fun, but I just don't remember what the arguments were. Dorothy Walsh, by the way, was one of the group in my class who were taking honors in history
mm-hmm.
and English, mostly. Hunter Lewis and I took straight honors in English. But she went on and ended her career as a head of the history department at Bryn Mawr.
Mm-hmm.
And she was in a really distinguished teaching position, and she also has written a good deal
mm-hmm.
In philosophy. She wasn't in English, she was in English and philosophy, or philosophy alone, I'm not sure which. But she's had a very excellent
mm-hmm.
career, and she was extremely vocal. I mean, she expressed herself with
mm-hmm.
great accuracy and skill.
Yeah.
She's still living, but not in good health.
Mm-hmm.
Another one, Phyllis Mackay, was my special
oh.
friend in, well, in late years, you know, she taught out at Britannia High School.
Mm-hmm.
And died several years ago, and that was a great loss. She was on the PUD board.
Mm-hmm.
She was one of the people at the UBC. Jeffrey Boone, Jeffrey Coop, Harry Cassidy, who's the editor. Dorothy Walsh, Phyllis Mackay.
Mm.
I mean, those are the people that I knew particularly well. And I might interpolate here, in case you haven't come across much about the Letters Club, I do think that Torleif Larsen's
mm.
founding of the Letters Club was one of the most important influences in our years at the university.
Mm.
It was a very distinguished group of people, and I mean, considering the people who went on in
mm-hmm.
literary careers afterwards, and the standard was exceptionally high. And I think the relaxed and comfortable relationships within the group of 20, we were limited to 10 men and 10 women
mm-hmm.
in the third and fourth years. We met at private homes,
mm-hmm.
and Mr. Larsen was the mentor who sat quietly there and answered questions and gave
mm-hmm.
guidance, and later Francis Walker, also in the English department, assisted, and he was an extremely amusing there, mm-hmm. all sorts of puns and jokes and things, and we loved them dearly, and it was really great fun. And then after that, Lionel Hoist, who was in the library mm-hmm. UBC and also a very extraordinary and gifted person who got a job moving books about and doing just sort of silly chores in the library, whereas his background and his education was terrific and his writing was really most distinguished. Mm-hmm. And so you see, it was a very important thing.
Did you give papers each week?
Oh yes. I think I'm trying to remember. I've forgotten if we met every 2 weeks. Every 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
There was a paper, and it was discussed and criticized. And I imagine they all should be in the university archive.
Mm-hmm.
There's some very excellent ones.
Mm-hmm.
I remember Jack Klein's paper.
Oh yes.
Yeah, very well. I was so overworked in my last year that I asked if I could do it. Come and give my paper the next year, after my graduation.
And did they let you do that?
Yes,
did
that.
Do you remember the High Priest? I found that in downstairs in the stacks.
Yes, you found
and
a copy.
Beautiful pictures of the play.
Of the people acting in it,
and I took it upstairs, and it's now in the archives.
Oh.
Upstairs, because it was a precious piece that slipped by. And in 1922, that won the $50 Players Club Prize.
That was the first time the competition.
And you won. How did you happen to write that? And what did you feel when you won?
I'll tell you. Oh, dear. You know, one had to select lectures, you see.
Yes.
Because if you were taking an honors course in English language and literature, you had to take Anglo-Saxon, Middle English,
mm-hmm.
and Chaucer,
mm-hmm.
and then cover just everything else there was.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the whole sphere.
Mm-hmm.
That's why you had to have two examinations on the two main periods which you did not work in.
Right.
So I had chosen the 19th century for my job, and Cristina Rossetti and Dante Gabriel Rossetti, her brother, as my subject that I was writing on in my graduating essay. So what did you say? How
did you come to write the High Priest?
I had to choose courses.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked them over and I decided, I don't mean to be unkind, that Freddie Wood was very popular.
Yeah.
Very popular. I personally, in my teenage wisdom, considered he was a lightweight compared with the others. So I looked at the course on the novel, which everybody was taking, just loving it. And I said, well, heavens, I can read every one of those novels twice in the summer holidays. So why should I take the course on the novel? And then I thought, well, playwriting, that's something else again, you see. There wasn't any course in how to write verse. In any way, I probably thought I knew how.
You did that anyway, that's right.
So I took the course. And we had
playwriting,
and we were told to write a one-act play.
Oh,
you see. So I experimented. My first experiment, and I had pieces of it above still in my chest. It didn't turn out awfully well. And then I thought, well, I'll think of something else. So I thought of something else, and I wrote The High Priest.
In one go, just like that, or
while I was taking the course, and I. And then this competition was announced. I thought, well, wouldn't $50 come in terribly handy?
That was quite a sum.
Oh, it would have helped me enormously, being extremely hard up.
Good.
So I did, and I was just overcome with surprise. Oh, gracious.
When you won, that was tremendous.
Oh, dear. The people who acted in it, and the people in the Players Club, then
mm-hmm.
whom I still know and see, you see, Kirstine Leveson, and Jack and Betty Klein,
mm-hmm.
and various others. Whenever they remember that my play, they said, "Oh yes, the drums of oud."
Yeah,
and I said, "Nonsense! It's oud."
Out.
He tells it wrongly, And it was not the drums of old, it was the high priest. But they always laugh and say, oh, the drums of old.
It was a very dramatic, very romantic play.
Terrific.
Woman sacrificing herself for her husband. Yeah, did it relate to anything that you were thinking about at that time? I mean, did you think that women did make sacrifices for their husbands?
Oh, no. It was just to see if one could, with a slight background of living in India for 4 years as a child. And then I consulted Lam Hoyce, who was very up in Indian matters and philosophies and so on, you see. And I said, what Hindu deity should I have them appeal to, you see? And what kind of deity was this, you see? He told me.
Did they really make human sacrifices to Kali then?
Oh, I think so.
Oh, dear.
I think so.
I was hoping that was fiction.
Yeah. I have a novel about India that really draws a very grim picture indeed. Some of the practices.
You also did publish a chapbook, I think, or a part of that chapbook of poetry. Like Dorothy Walsh and several others.
Ah, yes. You've seen it, haven't you? I still have several copies, and I treasure one which everybody signed for me. That was a spontaneous undergraduate letters club thing, just on our own. It was nothing to do with any pressure from or interest in, really, from professors. I think probably, this is a guess, Phyllis Mackay, who didn't write verse, but was our special friend, you know. She was such a fine and meticulous scholar, you know, and a very delightful person, really the most unusual person. So anyway, she volunteered to do the secretarial work and to go around and get donations to help get it published. So she did. But it was entirely undergraduate, and all of the members of the letters club, one of them was a graduate, Rig, Alfred Rig. And of course our friend Lionel Hoyce, a funny little man, you know, with bob long hair, bobbed in very small, and his father was a canon in the Anglican Church. But he was a very a naughty sort of town. I gather his reputation was naughty, good in England. But his mother wrote numbers of novels.
But you had quite a bit of success. Do you actually manage to get it published and subscribed to?
Oh, well, there were only a certain number of copies published, you see, printed. It was, everything was done by us. Nobody published it for us. The money was raised, you see, Phyllis Mackay helped with that, or did most of it.
Did you also publish in the UBC any poems?
Oh yes, lots of them.
On the literary supplements.
See, I love one of my earliest ones, and this one.
Good.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
A lot of the women, as you were saying, went on to brilliant academic careers.
Yeah.
Did you know Sylvia Plath at all?
Yes, she was later.
And Dorothy Dallas?
Yes, she was in my class.
She went on, came back to teach, actually.
Yes, she's living now in Dunbar still.
Right.
She's not been in good health.
You've written to her.
She had an operation for cancer 10 years ago. And she's carrying on bravely, you know, but she's not strong.
Did there seem to be most of those women who went on remain single? Was there a definite choice that you had to make between getting married or going on in academic careers?
In my case, I think so. Yes, I think so. As you can imagine, at that time, it really wasn't possible for a woman to marry and have children and lead a normal married life and have a career. It wasn't. It just wasn't. Not only wasn't done, but there weren't the facilities to make, unless they were people of that wealth. And there, I might have, an observation of mine is that the most liberated women in this regard in the world, in the modern world, and the have been the women in the Middle East, you know, where an elite
mm-hmm.
is very well-to-do
mm-hmm.
and that household and domestic help
mm-hmm.
is available and cheap.
Mm-hmm.
But they were, they're the people who have been able to do this successfully and always have. But in North America, not so much.
Mm-hmm. And then we were going to mention Mary Bonnet.
Yeah.
And you said she had a fairly close connection with the Women's Undergraduate Society. She acted as your advisor.
Yes. She was a very pleasant person,
mm-hmm.
a very, what shall I say, she was, I should describe her as a professional person, which is a compliment.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, her relationship with the women's undergrad was excellent. Anybody could go and see her and discuss any sort of problem, whether it was connected with the university or personal doctor, personal problems. I never
mm-hmm.
felt the need of doing that. But she, I think she did some lecturing in the Department of English.
Mm-hmm.
Because, of course, as I learned by reading this, she was very well
mm-hmm.
qualified to do so.
Mm-hmm.
She also administered the IODE, I think, was on the committee that administered the IODE Traveling Fellowship, which
mm-hmm.
was inaugurated
mm-hmm.
and at that time. And I remember this because when I became engaged, which was in the summer after I graduated, I went to see Miss Bollett to tell her to
mm-hmm.
see that I had become engaged. And she said, "Oh, Miss Anderson."
That
she
time.
Said, "Why did you?" And I said, "No." And she said, "Well, I have you all lined up for the IOD Traveling
oh,
Fellowship."
No.
I said, "Too late, too late."
Who did it end up going to, did you know?
Well, I don't know if it was that one that Dorothy Bakey got, but she got it, but it may not have been that
mm-hmm.
year, it may have been the year before,
mm-hmm.
because the year after, I don't remember.
So she was disappointed in you.
But she was disappointed.
It was too easy just to get married. Should have gone on. And then there was Dr. McInnes, which would have been probably the only other woman on the faculty.
Yes, well, she was the, before, there were several appointments made when
mm-hmm.
Dean Bollett, she became Dean Bollett,
mm-hmm.
called that later. She was the only permanent staff appointment,
mm-hmm.
woman staff appointment, and I, most of the time when I was an undergraduate,
mm-hmm.
there were assistants, you know, who came
yeah.
in.
Because we see that she used to, before Mary Bollett came, Dr. McInnes used to address the fresh women as they came in and
mm-hmm.
give them a small talk on conduct and so on.
Yes, she did, and she was always very kind and friendly
mm-hmm.
to us and most helpful.
You were going to tell us about the discipline and conduct regulations. The ones about hair and smoking, did
mm.
they come from the women themselves, or was
oh,
Mary Bollett suggesting?
Oh, no. Nobody suggested anything to us.
Mm-hmm.
We made our own. Oh, no, there was no dictatorial statement or
mm-hmm.
hinting we should do this or that. As I say, we had more student self-government then
mm-hmm.
than I have seen since at UBC. What we thought important, and of course a lot of the students, particularly in the publications board, the UBC
mm-hmm.
board, were out and out rebels about everything. And I have been hearing the inside story of none of those things in a long letter only within the last 6 months or so.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine the end of one's life to be hearing. But they were very, very, we considered, way out in the general attitude.
Uh-huh.
Let us do what we like and so on, and why should we listen to it? But the advice that they got and the restrictions were all from people of their own age. So it was a little hard to rebel against
yes.
their own classmates, you see. So it was we that were putting our thumbs
uh-huh.
down and saying, well, look, what are they going to think of us downtown? We
mm-hmm.
want to get the university moved.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, that was the great triumph of my year,
mm-hmm.
see. And I was delighted to see the photograph of the committee
Tracking.
There.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Which you unfortunately missed the trek, but you said you had flu.
Oh, I had flu. But they didn't even call it the trek then. This was it Frank Turner? Frank something, who was executive secretary out of the Alumni Association, and he decided to call the whole thing the Great Trek. Well, it's a great, a nice, catchy name, but it really didn't describe it.
So you had considerable self-government, and you decided that the women ought to wear the hair up, and ought not to, well, you said you only restricted smoking, you didn't ban it entirely.
Oh, heavens no. No, and there was no question of ordering people to do anything. It was suggested that the two young women who wore their hair on their back were considered a little less dignified, because in my year, the people in the final year at UBC all wore gowns.
Yes,
we wore black gowns with the khaki cord to classes.
Mm-hmm.
You see, we hung up our coats and our caps or whatever, you see, in lockers. Then we slipped into, and I still have mine.
How long would that have been?
Oh,
did it come down to your ankles?
No, not quite. It was fairly, you know. And it was lightweight.
Mm-hmm.
And you can rush from building to building and keeps a shower off, that sort of thing. But we wore our undergraduate gowns all during the fourth year, and people were glad to. We were. I mean, we wanted to. It was a sort of uniform. It also underlined the fact that you were in your final year.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a decision of the students. We weren't told to. We weren't told what we should do or what we should not do by anyone except our peers.
Mm-hmm.
And that meant, you see, that when the undergraduates decided the university was to be moved, they got it moved.
Right.
And you see, my husband and a couple of other people on the faculty then volunteered to coach undergraduates who were going out to stump the whole province that summer and get petitions signed.
Mm-hmm.
So they gave them pointers about getting up and making short and appealing public addresses on behalf of the university. So Geoffrey Byrne wrote to me. He graduated in 24 and had a very distinguished career as a historian and university professor in the United States. And he said, when you praise the undergraduate initiative, you shouldn't forget that the young professors helped us enormously in coaching us.
Mm-hmm.
How to do it, you see.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how it was done. No, there was no pressure from above at all. Mm-hmm. I never remember Miss Bollett giving us advice on how to behave, or anyone giving us
help. Mm-hmm.
I think we would have resented it because we thought we knew how to behave.
Yes.
And what's more, we were highly responsible.
True. You were going to speak of the difference in the attitude of the undergraduates of your day.
Well, sometimes I'm told that because the university was very small and the student body was not over 1,000 at the time I graduated, that of course the important thing was that everybody knew everyone else. But of course this wasn't true, because the classes were held scattered far and wide around that area. That some were held in the basement of one of the churches nearby, for example. But I think the really important thing about the small size of the university was that everyone, every undergraduate who had anything on the ball at all, was recognized for performance and ability.
Mm-hmm.
So that I should think that in those days fewer people graduated with any kind of inferiority complex than ever since. And I do feel that strong feeling of inferiority is one of the worst things that anybody can start life with.
Mm-hmm.
And very few people, I feel, did in those days.
Including women.
Oh, including women, by all means. Including, I'm speaking of women particularly, as I belong to them.
Right.
We knew them better, but certainly I think that the average sense of personal achievement and worth was greater than now.
And what would you credit with that, with the professors or the
well,
system?
No, because it was the size of the of the university, it was small, so that people knew what everyone else was doing if it was in any way above average.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they were recognized for it. And communication was easier, too. I think it was partly that, but partly that people were there because they wanted to come. It wasn't because it was the fashion. It was because this was an opportunity for further education, which was there and available to them if they could manage it financially, and that the fees were small. There were very few scholarships, but as many people as possibly could and who wanted to go did. I think that was important. Now, the other difference between the university of those days and the huge university now is the matter of teaching. You see, it was an undergraduate university with only three faculties, arts and science, applied science and agriculture, the three. And there were a few MAs. For instance, Dorothy Blakey stayed on and took her MA, and several people did. But largely, it was everybody finished with a bachelor's degree of some sort. And that meant that you did not have a great deal of research going on by members of the teaching staff. The teaching staff were teachers, and we had excellent teaching. There was no question of people getting help with their own private research projects by employing undergraduates to do their research. So you did not have what I consider a denaturing of the teaching process in university because of ambitious private projects in research. Now, I think that's a fairly forthright and downright statement to me to make, but I think my husband would agree with that, that the research that was being done had to do with teaching, not with private research in another field.
There was no emphasis on publication as advancement.
No, no.
So
and people didn't get leave out with pay. They didn't get sabbatical.
No.
And so on and so forth.
Had to be there.
You see?
Right.
That was a modern.
You also want to talk about the age of the returning veterans and so on having an influence on you in the classes.
Yes, I think because they were not only a couple of years or so older than the women in the university because of their war service, they had also been through some pretty catastrophic experiences. But just as a mild example of how we had to sort of rise to meet challenges, when I was president of the women's undergrad, the then president of the Aggie Association came to me one day and said, Miss Anderson, a group of the Aggies from out of town is considering renting a house nearby so that they can batch, you see, have their own little group, and it's much cheaper than boarding, and we would very much like it if you would come and look over the house and tell us if you think it is a suitable one for us to rent. And I said, well, how sweet and kind of you to ask me. Of course I'll come. And I didn't know whether it was or not, but I went around and looked and said, oh, I think it's a lovely house. Yes, I think you should.
You'd never rented a house before in your life?
No.
That's tremendous how gentlemanly of you. I thought you should know.
And it was so, it was done so politely and giving me the impression that they thought that I knew about
it. Yes. How did women manage with accommodation? Did most of the girls stay in boarding houses or at home? Or
well, I suppose the majority of people who went to university lived at home,
mm-hmm.
but there were a group of them that came from the Okanagan and different parts of British Columbia, and there were private houses who were where they boarded. They had room and board,
mm-hmm.
and they were on 12th Avenue, you know, all the way from
mm-hmm.
Oak right up beyond Yukon Street and so on toward Maine.
Mm-hmm.
I stayed in one of those with a Mrs. Ross, who had a group of women undergraduates boarding there. There were perhaps five or six of us.
Mm-hmm.
When I came down to go to high school,
mm-hmm.
and then my mother and sister came down and lived with them.
Now, then when you did marry, you continued to take an interest in the things at the university, of course, because Professor Angus was on campus. He had some rather stormy times. I was reading in the UBC in the 30s when he defended the Japanese Canadians, the franchise, and so on.
Well, that was when you first married, he was very interested in fairness in
mm-hmm.
the franchise.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to go occasionally and hear him lecture. But it wasn't only the Japanese, East Indians, Chinese and Japanese. The Chinese were very badly treated,
mm-hmm.
you know. I mean, very shabbily
mm-hmm.
treated in the early days,
yes.
I feel here.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing was that at the outbreak of war,
mm-hmm.
he was attacked because he was then in external affairs
mm-hmm.
and couldn't reply about anything at all. Having advocated the
mm-hmm.
the vote for Japanese Canadian Canadian
mm-hmm.
born,
yes,
yeah. Oh yes, that was that was fairly stormy. I admit.
Did it ever at the time the franchise for women become an issue for you when you were on campus? The early days of suffragettes or women in Quebec, which still didn't get the franchise.
No, I don't remember that among the undergraduates at all.
No.
There were so many other things that were vitally important, and everybody you see was sort of under 21.
Anyway,
and
didn't vote.
You know, it didn't bulk very large, no.
Mm-hmm.
They were busy learning and not thinking of women's rights at that point.
Mm-hmm. And they seemed to be treated with equal rights on campus, so it didn't appear to them to be an issue.
No. I think treated with not only esteem but deference.
Mm-hmm.
It was very, very, the atmosphere was very pleasant. I have nothing but happy memories of it.
Was the real world a bit of a shock then for some of them when they went out?
Well, it may have been, but of course when I started married life and took on the responsibilities of learning to run a home.
Roy has appeared. Any message for him?
Now we're on the air?
Now we're on the air, and now we're going to talk about the 1961 chancellorship election,
yes.
in which Phyllis Ross was elected chancellor, and which you also ran, and you could tell us about how it came that the two women were both nominated to run.
Well, I was on a committee which had agreed on a nomination. It was an alumni committee, and we didn't know if any other people, of course, would be nominated,
mm-hmm.
and very often they were. And so I thought that this was an excellent nomination. Perhaps Mrs. Ross was our most distinguished woman graduate at that time. She had been a student of my husband's, as had
mm-hmm.
her son John. They were both pupils of his. So the nomination was made, and then I was called by a then member of parliament in Ottawa, who called me from his home in British Columbia and said that he would very much like to see an elected office kept elected,
mm-hmm.
and would I consider nomination to run
mm-hmm.
against Mrs. Ross, as it would be
mm-hmm.
a friendly sort of mm-hmm. contest and so on. I refused and said, oh dear, no. I didn't feel in the least capable of tackling that sort of job anyway. So I'm afraid that it was my good husband who argued that the important thing, of course he's a theorist, you must have realized, the important thing was to keep an elective office elective mm-hmm. and not have any university body deciding it, or the alumni association deciding it, or the president deciding it,
mm-hmm.
or whoever, that it should be left to convocation. And it was the only way in which the teaching faculty at UBC had a voice,
mm-hmm.
because they are automatically members of convocation,
mm-hmm.
whereas if there is no election, they would have no voice,
true.
You see. So he said, well, why not? Go ahead. So I said, well, I'll have to ask Sherwood Lett first, because Sherwood knows the ins and outs
mm-hmm.
of everything. So I telephoned to the Letts, and the Letts were both away.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to give my answer, because it was only a day or two that was left. So, encouraged by himself, I said, all right, I'll stand. And then I wrote to Mrs. Ross
mm-hmm.
and explained how this had come about. So that's how it was.
That's how it was. Well, we're just about at the end of our interview, and is there anything else that you would like to say to the women at UBC today, or give us some advice on how we can go about enjoying our years at UBC?
Well, I don't think I feel competent to give advice to people, after all, of a generation that is now the same as my grandchildren. I have five grandchildren, 22, 20,
18, 17, 15. Yeah, UBC?
Well, not, no. Two are at Simon Fraser.
Mm.
The eldest is now gathering together oddments of learning and taking a course at City College in order to be able to hopefully start UBC shortly. No, I don't feel competent to advise. The world has changed too greatly,
mm-hmm.
but I do want to say that I wish you very well in your project, and my interests are still and always have been with children and young people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that is what I have principally been busied with,
yes.
as a volunteer.
And the Regional Welfare Council and the Children's
Homes, many things.
Yes.
Yeah, many
things. So you've had a tremendous career, and do you feel that your beginnings at UBC were a good start for that career?
Oh, excellent. I think the beginnings of everybody at UBC in those days were an excellent start.
Good. Even though you were so cramped and crowded down at Fairview, did you think that that was a disadvantage?
No.
No.
After all, we didn't know any better, did
True.
We?
True. There was always Toronto, though. Did many of your friends go to Toronto instead as a better university, or was there a feeling that if you could, you ought to go back to
it? Oh, my friends were all UBC people. I didn't
mm-hmm.
know. You see, I was practically a stranger in Vancouver
mm-hmm.
when I came. But they certainly went far and wide for postgraduate
yes.
degrees.
Mm-hmm.
A number of them went to Toronto, but I might say here that the generosity of the American foundations was terrific
yes.
because I don't know, many of our most distinguished people of that era would never have been able, if they hadn't gone to the universities in the United States, and their scholarships and
mm-hmm.
their fellowships were most generous.
Is that why so many women went to Bryn Mawr, for example? It seemed to be a link between UBC
oh yes,
and Bryn Mawr.
Yes, and Smith College and so on.
And then on to London.
Yes. And of course, then we began to have some foundations
yes.
too, but we were very new.
And you were saying earlier that people in general did not have much money at the end of the war when you came
oh
back
no,
to school.
Oh no, everyone was very hard up. In fact, one of the graduates of 24 at the class reunion said that she really often hadn't been able to get a cup of coffee, spare
mm-hmm.
a dime to get a cup of coffee in the middle of a long morning studying.
Mm-hmm.
No, that sort of thing. She had to be so careful.
And there was no place for her to get any help on campus. They didn't have a loan fund or anything. I know that Dean Bollett later gave out money, even out of pocket.
I don't think my era, no. I'm sure Dean Bollett did, because
yes.
she started many excellent things.
Mm-hmm.
But the people just had to do the best they could.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And working in the summer was a difficult thing, you know, berry picking, yes,
yes,
but other jobs were hard to get,
mm-hmm.
I imagine.
Mm-hmm. So, thank you very much.
Well, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you.